Before the horse, we walked everywhere, and it was a downright slog to get just about anywhere. But 4,750 years ago, a mutant gene began working its way through the horse herds of the Eurasian steppes. Then, about 800 years ago, Genghis Khan raced those horses throughout the world to conquer one and all. And so today we pause to ask, have you ever been thrown by a horse? Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,401st edition of the Food Chain Radio Show and podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Buenos Aires who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I'm Michael Olson. Folks, having been raised in the grasslands of Montana, and from my early years a fan of the Plains Indians, I came to the notion that the apogee of American freedom occurred after the horse and before the barbed wire. With a good herd of horses, one's family and friends could follow the great buffalo herds, camp in majestic landscapes, and raid the villages of enemies to steal their horses and whatever else you could carry away. Of course, there were rules and regulations to slow one down, but as there are today, but the horse set you free to roam, and that was freedom. I came to this notion as a California college student who took a summer job on the Clint McFarland Ranch near the tiny prairie village of Moult, Montana. That ranch was perched atop a prairie benchland and underneath a monstrously big Montana sky. After the day's work was finished and the evening's chores checked off, I would saddle up one of the ranch's horses and ride out into the prairie to enjoy those long, lingering, high-latitude sunsets. Sometimes the exuberance of my freedom would overwhelm me. When that happened, I would nudge the horse into a run and whoop and holler with abandon, just like those prairie Indians did so long ago. So, of course, we are all fenced in now, horses, Indians, and cowboys. One can still find an occasional horse to ride and maybe even find a reason to whoop and holler, though please hold the abandon. Recently, I received a press release noting the publication of a book entitled Horses, a 4,000-year genetic journey across the world, and thought of all the whooping and hollering that book must have captured. And so today we pause to ask, have you ever been thrown by a horse? Here to take us on a 4,000-year genetic horseback ride through history, we have molecular archaeologist Ludovic Orlando, founder of Anthropology and Genomic Institute at Toulouse University and author of Horses, a 4,000-year genetic journey across the world. Ludovic, welcome to the Food Chain.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Notice how I got your book title in there about twice, maybe even three times, just in the introduction, right? So, is it true that somewhere along your great search for the origins of the horse, your wife gave you riding lessons?
Yeah, so, you know, I'm a scientist, right? And I'm passionate about DNA and what kind of messages we can learn in the genetic text that living things carry with them. But, you know, I ended up studying horses pretty much by chance. And
what do you mean by chance?
Well, I was 44, believe it or not.
An apple that fell on Newton's head.
Right, something like that. But I was only 44 when I started learning how to ride a horse. So I was not a horse person until very late in my life, actually. And when I say by chance, it's just because at some point in my research, I've came across some archaeological bones that were horse bones, basically. And I started studying them because this is really what I came across. But if they were, you know, something from a different species, then maybe I would have ended up studying another species. And there's a lot of that in the life of scientists, right? We tend to pretend that we anticipate everything, but really we do research to be surprised more than anything else. So by chance, indeed.
We all love serendipity, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So I became a sort of poor, I will say, horse rider very late in my life. But for sure, the last 15 years of my life have been dedicated to studying the DNA of the horse. So as much as I am a poor rider, I'm a fairly dedicated geneticist.
We're good. Have you been bucked off a horse yet?
Not yet. And I
Okay.
cross my finger that it will not happen
All
anytime soon.
right. Well, so you picked up some bones and you looked at them and wondered about them and you started looking into them. And what gave you the impetus to keep going? What was the fascination about those horse bones that kept you, that sent you on this incredible expedition through history? There must have been
Yes.
something that captured your attention there.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, when I started, and that would be probably a surprise to many, actually, there were questions, very simple questions. We had no idea what were the answers to those questions. Questions such as, when, where, how, who domesticated the horse for the first time? And this is like mind-blowing to really realize we didn't know the answers to those questions because, as you said in your introduction, horses shaped human history for many thousand years. So when you realize as a scientist, right, we have curious minds indeed, that such basic questions about ourselves and about our history were unsolved, well, you have no choice but studying them until someone, if not you, will find the answer. So the minute I realized that, I was hooked to some extent. And those questions were only a few out of the many that were actually left unsolved. So, the world was big, the question was big, the time period embraced pretty much all of human history. Here I was using DNA to try to solve some of them.
And it's so easy for us city people to neglect the history of the horse, having been confined by the barbed wire of cities, but we're all here. And what's a horse? You know, what is that? Something with four legs? What does that mean? But it really, the horse really was our first freedom, our first ability to get out and outrun anything. And so it really did have a big part in forming our history, and as we will learn as we go along on your adventure here. So there you are. So I'd like to learn a little bit before we go into the actual history of the horse about your project to track down the history of the horse. How did that start? You have this quest these questions, and you're a detective,
Yeah.
and you have to go about finding the answer. And what
Right.
tools did you use in this investigation?
Right. So that's a very fair question. So I'm a geneticist, so the tools that I like are DNA based somehow. And maybe to give you a sort of idea, DNA contains around 2.6 billions of genetic letters for the horse, 2.6 billions of letters. This is, dozens of thousands of books really that are written in this sort of genetic information. So that means a lot of information. And probably we will need a lot of information because the history was so complex. It unfolded in thousands of years. The other thing about DNA is that this is the molecules that parents transmit to their offspring. So basically, if you have the DNA through time, maybe you could actually walk back the DNA ladder and walk your way into history as it unfolded. So if you have the text, in the 19th century, in the 18th century, 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, maybe you will find your way with the DNA to actually get back to the very ancestors of all the domestic horses w that ever lived. And so that was the kind of rationale behind the project. Let's use DNA, but also let's use a sort of a genetic time travel machine that we call ancient DNA, the DNA that is preserved in archaeological remains. And if we can sequence it, then we could actually try to make sense of which horse is related to whichever horse. Remember, DNA is what parents transmit to offspring. So having the DNA tells you something about the family history of those domestic horses. And maybe if we're lucky, we will get back to the very first day when everything started. And we had a bit of luck in this journey because indeed we found this sort of primordial kind of ancestor. The other reason why we were so much into DNA is because DNA tells you about family history, but also about the individuals themselves. You know, if you look at my DNA, you will learn a lot of things that concern my biology. You know, the color of my skin, you will learn about a lot of things about me. So the same way will work for horses. We will learn about them, about their biology, in a way that is normally unexpected. When you're an archaeologist, you have horse bones, horse teeth, but you don't have the skin. You don't have their movements. You don't see them alive. They are long dead for thousands of years sometimes. But with the DNA, you can predict what was the color of their skin. So basically, you will be able to see what your eyes cannot see. And that was actually fascinating to realize that and to put some sort of flesh back onto the bones themselves.
And it was must have been a very interesting expedition to find the bones that are the oldest ones and the closest to what you're looking for. Because if you just start with regular old horse bones today, there must be I don't know how many different varieties of horses there are today. And you know, if you track those down, you might end up in Beulah, North Dakota, or someplace like that. It is incumbent upon you to find the oldest bones possible as you're
Right. It was
starting for it.
the oldest of the genetic type that made the human history, you know? So, and among in doing this this project, we realized that for sure today, and since the late 18th century, early 19th century, there is a lot of flavors to domestic horses, right? If you think about, you know, the Mustang is a type of domestic horse that went back feral, but you have, you know, Shires, Arabian horses, thoroughbreds, quarter horses. And if you look at them, you realize they don't look pretty much the same. They come in different sizes, colors, speeds, and more. But in fact, if you remove your glasses and just take a sort of DNA glass, you will realize they are pretty much the same. All of those horses, believe it or not, they are very, very close cousins. So if you look at those that live today only, you will be not able to go far back beyond the 18th century, pretty much in their history. Yet, you know, Romans, they had horses. Some steppe empires 2,500 years ago, they had horses. There are chariots with horses buried in the ground dating back to 4,000 years. So, of course, the history started much earlier. So, if you have the type that makes up the horses from the 18th century, you track in the 17th, in the 16th, in the 15th, and backwards in time until you only find a few bones that look like them. And on this genetic journey backwards, you know, the range of those horse bones that look like the same as the domestics of today was fairly large. It was indeed, you know, until the 16th century. It was until the 16th century, pretty much the whole world, really. Before the colonial time, they were pretty much in Eurasia and Northern Africa. But if you go back further back in time, you realize that actually their range was actually smaller before they expanded. And right at the beginning, you discover the small region where they were bred for the first time.
Okay, so we're going to go to that small region when we come back from this quick break. Folks, Michael Olson here. This is The Food Chain with molecular archaeologist Ludovic Orlando. Oh my goodness, this is going to be a lot of fun because we're going to go back in history and look and take a genetic horseback ride through 4,000 years of history to figure out where the first horses were and how they got to be everywhere, just like that. This is The Food Chain. We will be right back. Do stay tuned. Where did the first horse step out onto the ground and show itself? I don't think it was the jungles of equatorial Africa for some reason. It had to be someplace where they could outrun whoever's trying to eat them. That's my guess, just for starters. Ludwig?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, there were, although, it seems a very simple question to sort of answer that, saying like it's the steppes somehow where horses were actually domesticated. But in fact, scientists have wondered about the very location for like almost a century, really. And so, for sure, it was somewhere in Eurasia, Europe, or Asia, somewhere in deep history, probably many thousand years. But if you do the genetic journey backwards, you realize that there was a small region around the rivers that we call today the Don and the Volga. We are in the northern part of the Caucasian Mountains in southwestern Russia. And we have the region of about a few hundred kilometers wide, probably. Where people 4.2 to 4.7 thousand years ago started to do something with the local horses they had, right? The horse was wild, and there were wild horses pretty much everywhere across Europe and Asia. But those people specifically started to do something that no one else's did. Probably they started to have the idea that they could do something else with that animal. I mean, we domesticated other animals much earlier, like dogs for more than 15,000 years, cows for pretty much 10,000 years, or pigs and so forth. But horses, the idea came late. But those people had this sort of idea, and they started, and we see that genetically, to breed in a new type of bloodline. The wild horse started to be captured, probably, and only a few of those animals were bred together, like people will do when they control the reproduction of some animals to breed out a new generation. And so they started to do that in that region. They did that, according to our work, for probably about 5 centuries, and here they were. After 5 centuries, they were able to have selected an animal type that actually fitted their purpose, not just their purpose, because we see in the data that that bloodline spreads outside of that region that was really tiny to actually conquer the whole of Eurasia in almost a few centuries. So really, the breed that they created, the bloodline, was something unusual, something that no one else has seen. And we think that the thing that they have bred out was an animal that you could ride pretty much, or that you could move with. And the reason why I can say that confidently is that if you look at the DNA of those horses, those that became the thing for about a bit more than 4.2 thousand years ago, their DNA has special letters in some genes that we have deciphered, and especially one gene related to locomotor capacity, or probably motor coordination, starts to be favored. That version of the gene was actually very rare before that time, but at that time it became the thing that pretty much all horses on the planet started to have. But to give you a sort of idea, it's like when you do artificial selection. Imagine that you like one animal as a breeder. Probably you will breed that animal a bit more for fixing the capacity of that animal in the next generation, like modern breeders do. And this is exactly what those early people did more than 4,000 years ago.
Let's back up a little bit and talk about the steppes themselves, because it's hard to imagine the steppes as being what they really are, because sandwiched between the Gobi Desert and the forests of the Arctic, you think there couldn't possibly be anything of interest there, but it was like a great grasslands highway from China all the way to into Europe. And I guess if you were going to be an animal and to be a horse, it would be the perfect place to be, because it's grasslands forever. Parts of Montana are a lot like that as well. And so I was really considering in your book, you have a project called the Horsepower Project, where you're working with China and Mongolia. Could you describe that a little bit?
Yeah, so absolutely. About the step, first, I should say that, horses have just found a way to use the energy that was made available for free and forever by the grasslands of the steppe, right? And so those people who actually bred the horse, they invented a new way to tap into this almost infinite source of energy that came just naturally in those lands, right? So clearly it was revolutionary because if you're a pastoralist yourself, you live your life with herbivores such as cows, sheep, goat. The minute you have the horse, then you have a new herbivore to actually rely on. And that herbivore, because of the infinite amount of energy that comes with the steppe, actually helps you even become a better pastoralist. In that, with that, I mean that on the horseback, you could have larger herds, basically, because you could actually get a bit further away to get new lands, to get new grass. So you could easily picture the kind of revolution that that animal gave. It's not that horses made us able to invent pastoralism. Pastoralism started earlier, but horses helped us reach a new level, a whole new range of pastoralism. So about when it comes to horsepower, what we're trying to do in this project is really to use a range of technologies, including DNA, but not only, to try to see how the horse helped emerge the first steppe empires in history. And so in Asia, the first steppe empire is called the Xiongnu Empire. This is in the Iron Age, somewhere around 2,300 years ago. And people became nomads on the horseback. And those people, very specifically the Xiongnu, harassed the Chinese dynasty, right? And so, as a sort of response to the rise of the first steppe empire, you have a rise of the first imperial Chinese dynasty. So, what we're trying to do is really to understand how horses, an animal, actually could create empires, dynasties, therefore political power, the creation of states of a new kind or of a new scale, basically, which is, I think, a very clear image of what I'm trying to do on this book, which is to demonstrate at different time periods or places. So we go around the world, we travel back in history, 1,000 years, only a few hundred years, in fact, to realize something that we have forgotten, how much we owe to the horse today. Our history will be literally a different one should we not have got the horse in the first place.
And that you were working in China, in Mongolia, on the steppes, and there it was. It was all spread out before you, like a great grass highway going all the way to Europe. And so somewhere along in that place was that little tiny crescent of land where things really started to change. But was it the only one? I believe you had a,
No.
what was the name? The Batai?
Yes. So you're absolutely right. So I said that horses were domesticated late relative to, dogs, cows, sheep, goat, and that's very true. And that's actually quite a surprise to realize they came so late. But in fact, other people started to try to domesticate the horse earlier, not in the same region as the one that I've just mentioned, the North Caucasian range, but actually in Central Asia, somewhere around 2,000 kilometers east in the northern steppes of what we call today Kazakhstan, almost 1,500 years earlier, 5,500 years ago, some people started. So those people were not nomads. They were actually settled hunter-gatherers. They were actually hunting what was around them. What was around them was a lot of things, including horses. But those people, they made the decisions to pretty much hunt almost exclusively horses. And at the moment they were doing that, their environment started to change. Their environment was a bit more challenging for them to survive. And so as hunter-gatherers, not nomad people, they were settled. They couldn't just go somewhere else to try to find their hunts, right? So they were actually stuck in this region with their villages, if you will. So they just probably decided to try to do something with the horse, probably to make their resource more stable. So archaeologists working in this region at Botai, they discover not only the traces of those villages, houses and such, but also enclosures where horses were corralled 5,500 years ago. But the horses that were corralled were not those that gave rise to what we call the domestic horses. Those people, they sort of pre-domesticated the horse, but that horse never became the sort of fantastic mobility machine that we have rediscovered more than 1,000 years later.
Now, this countryside sounds like a lot like the savannas of Africa, from which people were said to have come from that kind of territory. We didn't really come out of the jungles, we came out of the savannas, which was a lot easier to manage for people and get around in. So, a lot similar kind of territory then, with respect to people themselves. And then, so in Batai, they started to actually develop these horses, as it were, and elsewhere, pretty much the same time or different times.
Different times, actually. So Botai and around. So Botai is north central Kazakhstan, somewhere around 200 kilometers northwest of the capital city of Kazakhstan. We call that city Astana. And around this region, within a range of a few hundred kilometers, that the people from that culture, the culture of Botai, did what we just discussed, right? They domesticated or they managed a horse locally. But those people actually vanished. It's not like they survived for long. We see that in the DNA, not of the horse, but of the people themselves. And so their trace is lost a few hundred years later. So those people, they started to do something with the horse, but since they did not survive, their knowledge and their culture did not was not passed on. And therefore the horse they had probably went back feral, went back into the wild. And in fact, in our genetic journey, we rediscovered the trace, the genetic trace of that animal in the 19th century and still alive today as what we called the Przewalski's horse. The Przewalski's horse is what we thought was the last truly wild horse living on the planet. The funny thing with DNA is that we could demonstrate that this is not really so. This is more the sort of surviving descendant of the first experiment that mankind did with the horse 5,500 years ago, trying to domesticate them. But 2,000 kilometers west of that region in the Northern Caucasian Range, more than 1,000 years later, so somewhere around 4.2 thousand years ago and a few centuries before, some other people from different cultures, not at all related to the Botai people, started to do the real thing that will end up becoming the domestic horse, the one that you have in the US, that we have in Europe, that they have in Northern Africa, in Asia, and that we have for 60 million of animals, 60 million around the world today, and that we call domestic horses.
Where was that?
Where
Yes.
specifically? That was so this Northern Caucasian range. If you want to be more precise, you could call that region the lower Don Volga River basin. So this is two rivers that actually are mixing into each other. Probably, if you picture Moscow, that will be 500 kilometers southwest of Moscow, probably 200 kilometers east of Ukraine.
Okay, so we're still in the steppes.
Oh, yeah, definitely. We are in what we call the southwestern Russian steppes or the Eastern European steppes, depending on your perspective.
Okay, and quick parenthetical, I'm going to take a break here in a couple of minutes, but I got to wondering, listening to you follow these genetic leads all over the place, where and how do you get the genetic information from something that's been dead for thousands of years? What, I mean, what are you scraping things off bones? How do you do that?
Yeah. So that's fascinating, in fact. So we scientists know that DNA survives in biological tissues for sometimes 100 years, 1,000 years, even up to 2 million years when you're very lucky. The biological tissues, most of the times, they are bones, they are teeth, because this is a hard tissue. So even time is not, something that could get rid of them. If you think about, skin, it will go very rapidly during history. But bones and teeth, they resist. And so if you have bones and teeth, you can drill a small hole in a tooth or in a bone. Small, very small indeed, something like, a millimeter large, not so much more. We actually need these days not even a gram, actually a quarter of a gram, even less of a bone material is enough to recover enough DNA molecules to actually sequence not just a bit of DNA, but actually the whole text that makes up the genome of an ancient individual. So these technologies have emerged, very much in 2010, around that time, because new kinds of DNA sequencing instruments have been developed. We call them high throughput DNA sequencing instrument or next generation DNA sequencing instruments. Those instruments, they have the capacity to really sequence, as I'm speaking, dozens of billions of DNA molecules in parallel overnight, basically. Since they have such a capacity, you can actually sequence a lot of the DNA molecules that will be preserved in the bones or in the teeth. Oftentimes, the molecules that you have, they are not those that you're interested in. They are not those from the horse, because a lot of microbes are actually contaminating the bones from the soil, right? But you can get the DNA sequence and compare that to what we call a horse today to find by matches basically those DNA bits that look like what we call a horse today. And this is how we could make sure that the DNA that we're sequencing are actually the horse-like DNA that we want.
Well, something tells me you need a very big computer as well. They
It's massive computers. It's actually hyper performance clusters that we definitely need. You can't do that with your own brain and with your own eyes. Basically, you need lots of maths and lots of computational power indeed to solve the puzzle.
Okay, folks, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, molecular archaeologist Ludovic Orlando, and we're going to focus in on where that horse started, the real horse, the one we ride, and the one that throws us off. Do stay tuned. This is Food Chain. Michael Olson, right back.
How would you like to be part of a great mission?
You can help the Epoch Times fight for a free press.
America's news outlets no longer tell you the truth. In fact, 90% of the media is owned by just six corporations.
But honest traditional journalism isn't dead. You can find it in the pages of the Epoch Times. Go to readepoch.com and try it.
1 month for just $1.
When you do, you're supporting real news and helping us in the fight against fake news.
You'll read the truth about how China promotes communism inside the United States and why so many American companies hide the truth about China.
You'll read stories about American politics written without a political agenda.
It's journalism that you don't get from our dishonest legacy media and without the tyranny of big tech.
Be part of a great mission. Subscribe now, 1 month for $1 at readepoch.com. That's readepoch.com.
Life is short and family is everything. Celebrate both with a Sunkist family reunion. Hello, I'm Heather from Sunkist Explorations. I will take care of all of the details for your family reunion vacation so you can have the time of your life.
Hello, I am Dennis. I enjoy getting the extended family together, which isn't easy. Heather with Sunkist Explorations is able to take over the planning and execution of these trips, and everyone raves over the enjoyment and memories we make. I recommend her for any of your travel needs.
Celebrate life and family with a Sunkist family reunion that will leave a lifetime of memories for everyone. I am Heather with Sunkist Explorations, and I will take care of all of the details for you at no additional cost. Call or click sunkissedexplorations.com. sunkissedexplorations.com.
Now's the time to weed out next summer's aquatic weed problems with the help of Coastal Aquatics. Coastal Aquatics specialized purpose-built work boats can rid your stream, pond, lake, or wetlands of next summer's weeds quickly and efficiently without chemical poisons that lead to toxic biomass buildups. Coastal Aquatics work boats operate in as little as 12 inches of water and can pull everything from duckweed to cattails out of the water by the roots. Coastal Aquatics can clear next summer's weeds out in less time, less effort, and the cleanup will last five times longer than with poisons. Think of your savings. Do not wait until it's too late. Send photos of your aquatic weed problems to coastal-aquatics.com for a free, no obligation estimates. That's coastal-aquatics.com. Water weeds away.
And there we are, in the lower Volga Don Valley of the Russian steppes. That is where it all started. Ludovic Orlando, what was it like way back then?
Yeah, well, the world was actually quite changing at that time. You know, people that are not geneticists, but who are studying climate change, for example, have demonstrated that around that time, the world has become a lot drier, actually, in that region. So there is a sort of coincidence to realize that at the very place where horses started to be domesticated, at the same time as they were selected for mobility because of the genes that we see in the data sustaining a larger or a more unimproved motor coordination, it's striking to realize that the world was drier. And if you're a pastoralist, and if your food, the grassland, is actually vanishing because it becomes drier, it kind of makes sense to have the horse to get faster somewhere else, basically, or probably to actually scout for new grasslands faster, basically. So the world was changing. And what is fascinating, I believe, is that in this part of the world, which is relatively small, the lower Don Volga region, it is not one material culture that archaeologists can excavate. What they call material culture is the kind of pots that you find in the excavation sites. It's not of one kind. It's actually if different cultures that you can see with different pots. Also, if they look at how people buried their dead in that region at that time, well, you have different types of funerary practices in that region. So what they think is that when it comes to the culture of those people, they were different. There were multiple cultures around. And what is really fascinating to me is to realize that people with different kind of cultures, so probably different ways to bury their dead and different ways to even like store their food in pots and so forth, actually all converge into domesticating that animal. And from that very small point in space and time, very rapidly, other people around, and we see very much that in our data, like a few hundred kilometers east or a few hundred kilometers west, in less than a century, you see that horse type that was unique to that region now spreading outside, like a wildfire to some extent, right? We see it, for example, in Anatolia, the region that we call Turkey today. We see it in 50 years after that. We see them in Kazakhstan, right where the Botai people started their domestication of more than 1,000 years earlier. We see that 50 years later. We see them in Europe, in the Carpathian Basin, in the region that we call today Hungary, for example. We see them in 50 to 100 years. In fact, in a very recent work that we've just published, we saw that they arrived in Spain and Portugal, which is the far west end of Europe, in 250 years. So you realize that in a few centuries, really, what was a very small phenomenon in the steppe became a global phenomenon that stretched pretty much from the Atlantic to the Pacific.
And what we're really looking at here is how in this tiny slice of the steppes, they figured out that by domesticating animals, they could control their reproduction of the animals. And in controlling the reproduction, well, that's the history of it all, isn't it?
Absolutely. So that's the thing for a biologist, you know, when you think about control of reproduction, reproduction is a biological function. And that's probably why we found those sort of answers that only biologists could find that as opposed to other kinds of disciplines, right? So they control the reproduction many ways, at least two ways, according to our data. One is that they bred. Literally, they cherry-picked some horses. It's not like they were trying to do everything with every single horse. On the contrary, only some animals, probably because they had some qualities those animals they lacked, qualities such as more mobility, but also more docile according to our DNA tests. You have versions of genes that change the behavior of the animals that are actually selected by those people at that time, right? So they bred a new kind of bloodline that fit their purpose, more docile, more mobile, and probably other characters that we could not yet decipher. So that's one control of the reproduction. You cherry pick, you choose who gets to breed out the next generation. That's the first thing. The second thing that they controlled is how fast you produce the next generation. You know, on
Right.
average, in the wild, a horse will get offspring every 8 to 10 years on average. You could have a horse earlier, but chances are that they will actually not survive long, right? So on average, that will be 8 to 10 years. But what we see in our data is that right at that time, the people made it happen so that it was not 8 to 10, but more so 4 years between two generations. So that means that probably through calling or other kinds of techniques and practices they developed, they could now produce a generation twice as fast, every 4 as opposed to every 8 years. And so when you realize that, you realize that this is probably why they could actually make that bloodline spread across the world, simply because they had the way to manufacture, to produce that new vehicle that was the horse way faster than anyone else's, basically.
Would you address the horse and the Mongol culture a little bit? Because to me, that horse was the culture of the Mongols, and it was what made them such an awesome force of civilization, I guess, or anti-civilization, depends on how you look at it. They were extraordinarily horse people.
Yeah, so I would say civilization, definitely not anti-civilization. I mean, what some people like Genghis Khan did is amazing, right? From just the power of the steppe, probably a very bright man, a lot of organization, but thanks to the horse, he managed to get an empire stretching across 10,000 kilometers, right? So that's really definitely something. It doesn't just happen by chance. And it's true that if you think about Mongolia, even I was in Mongolia last week, in fact, you think about Mongolia like a horse country. It is very true. But what is very surprising in archaeology is that it was not the case 4,000 years ago. In fact, people studying the archaeology of Mongolia tend to agree that horses became a thing in that region pretty late in human history, somewhere around 3.2 thousand years ago or 3.4 thousand years ago, depending on who you ask specifically. And that imagine even if that is 3.4 thousand years ago, that will make it at least 600 or 800 years after horses were first domesticated
Oh.
in the lower Don Volga region, thousands of kilometers west of that region. So even though it's true that for the last 3.2, 3.4 thousand years ago, Mongolia has been a horse country. It used to be a time when Mongolia was not a horse country at all, and people were using other kinds of herbivores or were actually hunting, if not doing some pastoralism in that region.
A lot of trudging about on their feet, I would suspect, without the horse. My goodness, it must have been a lot different, and that's why I kind of suggest that here in in America, the true apogee of freedom was after the horse and before barbed wire, and there it was. So the horse got out, and I guess Genghis Khan really demonstrated the efficacy of what a horse could do for a civilization, and so the horse spread all over the world really quickly then. It had a function, it had a great asset, which is speed. And
Speed, but I will say also strength. Imagine yourself at war. you're on your feet. And your enemies, they have the horse and they charge you, right? So imagine the impression you will feel, right? Obviously, it's mobility, but that's also power. And that's what is fascinating about this animal. This is not a random animal, right? This is an animal that can make you go way faster than you could, that can actually help you kill your enemies. So it revolutionized warfare. But that's also a bit later in human history, an animal that you could use for farming, actually, right? You will plow way more efficiently with a horse than you would by with your own means, but also with a cow even. So that's an animal that all it, that had it all in one package to some extent. And there is another dimension of the horse that I want to stress a bit here, is that the horse is no random animal also. You have probably experienced that yourself. You mentioned some parts of your life when you were riding, looking at the sunset and so forth. And the horse is an animal that you could actually feel you understand. It's like you have a communication with this animal. There's a sort of intimate dialogue that goes in your brain and probably in their brain as well. And so because of that, I think that the horse has another kind of power, which is the power to connect with us. And probably that's why people from the past, and the past could be history, but could be prehistory as well, have been fascinated by the horse. Maybe some religions or some, you know, cultural practices have developed on the horse. You know, I'm from a country in France where probably 200 kilometers away from me here, you have some caves from 15,000 years ago or 20,000 years ago, and the animal that you see represented the most is the horse. Probably because those people could, you know, relate to that animal, and even though they did not domesticate it, they could sense that this animal has some kind of spirit, has some kind of power that can actually be used to, you know, for a number of applications, perhaps religion, perhaps to help us travel in other dimensions, who knows. But, and this is a common story that I hear time and time again when I travel the world. When I go to Mongolia, they tell me about the superpower of that animal. When I travel to the US, talking to some First Nations, including the Lakota, for example, this animal has really something special to those peoples. They see multiple dimensions in this animal. So, of course, I'm thinking with my genes about, you know, mobility, power, war, but there is also equally another dimension that genes will not unfold, which is what we experience in our own intimacy when we are next to a horse.
When you were talking about that intimacy, and I was thinking about my horseback rides under that, under the sunsets, and I also had a dog. And there was the three of us, man, horse, and dog. And it was like, it was all there, a community, and we were all speaking in a language that you couldn't write down, but it was there. It was amazing stuff. Well, here we are, Ludovic. We're all penned up behind barbed wire now, living in that great confined animal feeding operation we call the city. And what's to become of the horse?
Lots of different things, right? So maybe what I should say first is that the same way we could track the origins of the horse, we could actually see history happening for 4,000 years, right? You mentioned Genghis Khan. Of course, we sequenced some horses that belong to the great Mongolian Empire. We did the same with Alexander the Great. We did the same with Napoleon even more recently, and so on and so forth. But what our genetic journey revealed is that in the last 200 years, the horse genetic diversity started to change a lot. Actually, we have lost a lot of the diversity that was available simply because we humans across the world have developed a new way to breed the horses. By doing inbreeding, you actually reproduce those of the same kind and only, you know, the tall with the tall ones, the small with the small ones, and so forth. And that actually comes with a reduction of the diversity that was out there, creating the breeds that are so different morphologically, right? So that's for the last 200 years, pretty much. We estimate that there is about 16% of the pre-existing diversity that was lost in less than a couple of hundred years. So that means that if we keep doing that, well, the future of the horse doesn't look bright, isn't it? Right. So what will come in the next decades or so depends a lot on our choices. And so, of course, there are very, very brave people around the world developing some conservation efforts to actually preserve the genetic heritage of that animal, also cultural heritage. So the same goes in the Americas or in Eurasia or in different parts of the world. But also some other people have started to use other tools to sort of change the future of the horse. And if you think about the sport industry, for example, if you think about the polo industry in Argentina, they have started to clone horses. In fact, in America, in the US, it's not just the polo horses that is cloned. Also, the Kowalski's horse has been cloned, the one that was endangered and that has become extinct in the wild since the late 60s, right? So there are tools available to us today that could rewrite a new type of history for horses, a future history of the horse. We could change the genetic information of the horse to change their capacity, or we could actually remove some of the bad mutations that some horses carry and that make them sick. And all this sounds maybe like science fiction, but it's not. This is something going on in the real world in some parts of the world, such as Argentina and Texas in the US. So basically, who knows what our future is going to be like? But certainly, since the horse is such fascinating animal, for sure we are gonna use some of the technologies to write together another chapter of their history.
Ludovic Orlando, I'm so jealous because it sounds like you've been having so much fun chasing down the history of the horse. You call that work? Come on, way to go. It's a fascinating story, ladies and gentlemen. So pick up a copy, give it a read, and go for a horseback ride of your life. And go ahead, go out there and get on a horse. It's a lot of fun, I guarantee it. Thank you, Ludwig.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.